Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God. And we're going to be talking about Genesis chapter 39. And of course, how we got to Genesis 39 is we started with Genesis 1. I don't know if I've even done a program on Genesis 1, but it really is the foundation. The book was written to give us a foundation for what God was doing through Moses and the Israelites. But it wasn't to exclude the Israelites from the rest of creation. They are an instrument in creation, just like the tree of knowledge is an instrument in creation, and the tree of life is an instrument in creation. It's an ongoing reality that God uses not only, you know, the creation itself, you know, the fish and the wildlife and the trees and, you know, the birds and the sky, everything that flies, all these things are instruments of creation, and somehow or other, this unmoved mover, this God of creation, this divine designer has put his mark in everything that he has created. He has put his, they actually talk about, you know, before the mark of the beast, there'll be people that receive the mark of God. And does that mean they're going to get a chip from God that is going to be embedded in them? Or is the mark of God really spirit? I mean, we see at the beginning of Genesis, in the beginning, God, whatever God is, created heaven and earth. And that creating of heaven and earth is designing heaven and earth. God being Elohim in the Hebrew text, being this Aleph Lamad, Hey, Yad, Mem, Elohim, which is actually composed of, you know, lots of letters, but also letters that form other words. And it's translated a lot of different ways. I mean, it's translated God over 2,000 times in the Bible, but it's also translated goddess and judge. 5 times it's translated judge. The same word that we say is Elohim is translated judge. And it's also, you know, over 200 times it's translated small g God. Which would mean those small g gods are also could be referring to judges. Occasionally it's translated great or mighty or angels or something that's exceeding. And even Jesus, of course, we see the Jesus text in the Greek. They use a different word, theos, which also means judge. Theos means God, but it also means judge. And it was a common term used in courts of law when addressing the judge at that time in history. He was the God of that court. And if you go into courts today, sometimes the judge thinks they seem to act like they are gods. At least in that court, they're the ruling judge. And so understanding that there is lots of little judges, lots of little gods, lots of little, you know, ruling judges in little jurisdictions throughout the world, there's also a divine God, a designer, and he's put everything into motion. And a lot of people don't want to believe that. They want to say they're atheists, but they're simply substituting the spiritual God of creation for whatever gods are in their world, whatever small g gods are in their world. And, of course, all the prophets, Abraham, as we've been studying as we're going through Genesis, and of course Abraham's mentioned in the New Testament and mentioned throughout the Old Testament as kind of the father of the nation, but he received a blessing from somebody else called Melchizedek, and it's a little bit of confusion as to who Melchizedek is, but evidently he was a guy traveling around and well known. He was Melchizedek actually means the righteous king. And so he's a king, he's righteous, and he received tithes from Abraham. Abimelech didn't receive tithes from Abraham, but Abimelech was a father king, and he had another way of getting his support. He kind of compelled his support. He may have done it very benevolently. He may have been very frugal with the support that he was given, but he was the father of a nation. This is a common concept in creating governments. There was a lot of that going on at the time of Abraham, because there, you know, there'd be 10 people over here, and then there'd be 100 people over here, and the 100 people could kind of overshadow the 10 people. So they were figuring out ways to gather together to protect them from some of the not so nice guys that are out there who might be a little bit authoritarian or just flat out criminal in their behavior. And so they were forming governments and building cities and putting walls around these cities. And I always remember during the Peloponnesian Wars, there was some city-states who were fond of building walls around the city-states, going to other city-states who really didn't have walls around their cities, and offered to loan them money to build their walls so that they could have a wall too. And one response from a freedom-loving city-state that had no walls to Athens, who was offering to loan them money to build their wall, they simply responded that we are our walls. What they do, how they lived, how they protected one another, they were their walls. They protected one another with their walls. And their wall was themselves. And they survived the Peloponnesian Wars. They suffered, but they were around for a long time. And as a matter of fact, they were known for wearing a red cap, which has become a symbol of some military forces even today, wearing this Frisian cap of liberty, kind of a representation of liberty. They didn't always stay at liberty, because liberty, like the kingdom of God, is from generation to generation. Which is why we mentioned Melchizedek, who blessed Abraham and may have been a descendant of Abraham may have been a descendant of Melchizedek. And he finally blessed one of his descendants, and the one he chose was Abraham, because Abraham was doing something different. He wasn't doing what all the other people, wasn't doing what Bera, king of Sodom, was doing. He wasn't doing what Abimelech's were doing. He wasn't doing what the kings of Ur were doing. He wasn't even doing what his father Terah was doing. His father Terah was an idolater. We had a discussion on X that came up, what idolatry was. And a lot of people won't like the answer. But Paul tells us what idolatry is. I mean, he tells it very clearly. And of course, you can look it up. And then if you look at, you go to preparingyou.com and look up our articles. This is where I have notes on Genesis. And even though I haven't done audios for every single chapter in Genesis, I've got notes in almost every single chapter in Genesis, or some sort of links to certain verses or words that show up time and time again. But in that beginning, when God created the heaven and the earth, he talks about, and the earth was without form. It lacked some sort of design. If there was an earth, there must have been some sort of natural design to it. I mean, I assume that it had, land of some sort. But he says, it was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. So this is only the second verse, and supposedly he hasn't even created the planet yet. He hasn't divided light from darkness and everything. But as we've seen in so many of the other chapters, everything that is written is not always written in consecutive order. that they will write about something that they're going to talk about next as if it's already a done deal. And then they will go back and elaborate after they mentioned the done deal. And we saw that in Genesis 38 and 37. Where there was this idea of where there was Joseph who was walking around in a coat of many colors. He was clearly the favorite son of his father. And his brothers were jealous of this. And then he comes along with this dream in chapter 37, which we've already covered. And we have audios up along with all the notes that we've added to it. And we've been adding more notes as we go along because it all starts tying together. But he already saw that his brothers were going to be bowing down to his authority. He didn't necessarily know what that meant, but he knew he was already seeing it before it happened, and he's talking about it in chapter 37. And they didn't like that because they didn't see what he saw. Their eyes were still in darkness, which if we go back to Genesis 1, we see there was darkness already, and we needed to bring light so that there wasn't darkness anymore. And darkness and light are always related to good and evil. And so what is darkness? Darkness is simply the absence of light. You can't go out and buy a dark flashlight where you turn on the flashlight and a beam of darkness shines out into the light. No, light exists. Darkness exists where light doesn't. We call that absence darkness. Same as cold and hot. Cold is the absence of heat. And good is a positive reality, a virtuous reality, evidently in accordance with the nature of the divine designer. And sin is the absence of that harmony with the divine designer. Sin includes the idea of darkness, something less than righteousness. Righteousness would be equated with light. Unrighteousness is simply the absence of what we would call righteousness. So that's very important as we begin to try to find out what's the Bible all about. It seems to me when I read the text, when I look at the Hebrew, that when Joseph is talking about his dream, he's pretty young. He's talking to his older brothers, and he's saying something that he just sees as a fact. It's a dream. But they could interpret dreams enough to know that, wait a minute, are we supposed to bow down to him? And then later on, he tells the dream to his father, and his father, you know, like, am I supposed to bow down to you also? But his father's reaction was a little bit different. He thought there was something to what Joseph said because he knew Joseph. He was a special kind of guy. And we're going to see that when he gets thrown into bondage in Egypt, when he gets to Egypt, other people recognize this guy has got talent. This guy has got a blessing. People saw that about Abraham. Abimelech saw that in Abraham, blessed Abraham because he saw Abraham was blessed. But he saw something in him. And then, of course, we're going to see this over and over again. But the darker your eyes are, the less likely you are going to recognize the goodness, the righteousness, the revelation, the blessedness of Joseph. The darker your eyes are, the farther you are away from the light. Remember, later on in Genesis, Adam and Eve flee the light. They flee the truth. And the truth is, we're all sinners. And so we have to be willing to see that in order to approach the light. Now, approaching the light has challenge of its own. Somebody was talking to me just seconds before the show began and talking about how he was talking about socialism on some forum. And people don't want to think that the United States is a socialist nation. And to some degree, if we hold up this sample of socialism and this sample of socialism, we can say, oh, we're not like that nation. But it doesn't mean that we don't have a socialist tendency, that we desire to be a part of the spirit that resides in what we call socialism today. And what resides in socialism today is that we become a collective, and that somehow a gathering of some sort, and those that produce extra share with those that don't produce as much and may have greater needs, you know, from you according to your ability to everybody according to the needs. But it's always defined as a political system. It's not a system of charity like the early church, which, you know, I was also early this morning, I was translating Pliny the Younger because I kept reading the translations that were regularly available. And I thought, like, this doesn't seem right. And so I've created a page where I can compare the two. And, you know, my translation or other people's translations. And there's quite a few different ones out there. And some of them, I was noticing it was very difficult to find, okay, now what verse are we in? Because they don't always number them. And you're looking at this guy's translation, and you're looking at this guy's translation, and you're thinking, like, are they translating the same material? And so, of course, we can do the same with the Bible. And, of course, we do on a regular basis look at how are the translators. I know the guys who wrote it were inspired, but I'm not always convinced all the translators are inspired. But like I say, if you're going to read the Bible, in order to understand it, you have to be inspired. Well, Joseph was seeing things inspired by dreams. He was still young. His frontal lobe was not fully developed yet, but he was having these dreams, and he was seeing things, and he was sharing them with his brothers, but they couldn't see it. As a matter of fact, what they could see of it, they didn't like. They didn't realize that he could be blessing them when the famine came, but they decided to remove him from the equation. They were going to cancel Joseph, you know, censor Joseph, you know, and we see that spirit in the world today, where there's a lot of people who want to cancel you, tear down your flyers, tear down your posters, you know, censor your speech. They want to do that. That's a spirit. That's not the spirit of God. Because in God's kingdom, there is free speech. You get to say. I mean, if you're not allowed to say what you're thinking, we won't know if you're stupid or not. So I say, let him speak. We'll find out where he stands. And in court systems, that has always been really important, to let the people speak. I was reading court, you know, reports on a court case recently, or at least in the last 4 or 5 years. I was reading that this morning at 4, before I actually got up. That was a story in the news, and I won't go into it. We'll get off track, but the fact is the courts were hushing people up. They didn't want to bring in this evidence, didn't want to bring in that evidence. And, because it might prejudice the jury. Well, if you don't bring in the evidence, then the juries, how are they going to decide fact and law? Because in Oregon, the Constitution says the jury can decide fact and law. But I haven't seen a jury, and I've seen a lot of juries in Oregon. I haven't seen one in my lifetime that could decide fact and law, or even knew that they could decide fact and law. I've run across a few people who think they should be able to do that, but they don't understand. And so I've added to our page on jury at Preparing You. You can go read that. And added a number of pieces of information, because the same thing was going on in Mexico. Same thing was going on in a lot of places. Many of the states have it in their constitution. Certainly it was advocated that juries had the right to decide fact and law. And even coming to America to find freedom, some of the people that first came to America had already had this battle in England, that a jury his conscience should be his own. And he can actually overrule in a common law court. He can overrule the parliament and even the king himself by acquittal. He can say, oh yeah, he broke the law. He broke the law here. He broke the law there. But we're going to acquit him anyway because we don't think his intent was criminal. We get it that you made this law for a reason, but we don't believe his intent reaches to being criminal. We're judging the fact he did it, but the law would be a violation of justice, a violation of righteousness if we convicted him. A jury could do that in America. It was considered a duty for a jury to do that. But now they don't even want to teach you that. It's still in the Constitution, but most of the people I've seen in lots of juries, in not only this state, because I went to juries when I was a kid. I think the first time I saw a jury was, I was like 9 years old. Or at least I was in a jury room. I can't remember much of what was said until I saw a jury later on when I was in my early teens. I would go to court with my dad and see what the jury was doing and what it was saying. Those juries couldn't decide fact and law. And because there were changes. But they brought about the change. But you have to go read that article. Let's delve deeper into what Joseph, he already sees that he's going to rule over not only his brothers, but he's going to rule in a position where even his father has to bow down. And his father is kind of shocked by that information, but he's not moved to jealousy and envy because he drinks at the well of Bathsheba. And those of you who have been following along know what I mean by that. So what does it tell us in 38, which was kind of a sidetrack deal, where Judah was following a way counter to that of Abraham, more along the idea of Nahor and Laban. And he was going out of the way. And that chapter is put in there to show us that God is still there, counting on things. But we'll talk about that when we return to Keys of the Kingdom after a brief break. So we'll be right back. Well, welcome back. So before we go on, I wanted to mention one thing. I was just looking back at that chapter where we were talking about Judah and Tamar. And I'd had questions about this before we even got to the chapter that people were asking me. And I tried to address their concerns. And this word Tamar, she plays the prostitute. But she isn't really a prostitute. She's collecting what is owed her, which she was promised the seed of Judah through her son, his sons, but she never got it. She was cheated out of it, or she was just simply neglected by Judah. But Judah had already gone out of the way, but yet she wanted the seed that she was promised so that she could bear a child. It used to be that women grew up right away and still with the idea of having a child and bearing the next generation. We began this particular show with the kingdom of God is from generation to generation, and that is not possible without women. That they play an absolute critical role, and they were designed to play that critical role. It's different than the role of men, but they are vessels of the Holy Spirit. They're also the vessels of the next generation, physically the vessels of the next generation. And Tamar was being cheated out of that because her clock was ticking. And she was being put off by Judah, who didn't see the unrighteousness of what he was doing. Because remember, unrighteousness is simply the absence of righteousness. Just like darkness is the absence of light. But her name, Tamar, Tav Mem Resh, it appears a number of different spellings in these chapters of 38. I mean, it will show up. It actually will be mentioned in Ruth and in 2 Samuel. But she is part of the lineage down to Christ. But Tav is the letter for faith, Mem is the letter for flow, and Resh is the letter for authority. I don't see her name ever written where it's Tav, Mem, Resh, Resh. We talked about that recently on the X show, why the double Resh. We've talked about it a lot of times. Wherever you see a double letters, it has a double meaning. And we actually see double letters in some of the same verses where Tamar shows up. It's like 2 Samuel 13, verse 10, where there's a word there that has a be it, double letters again, which usually has to do with in spirit and truth. And in 2 Samuel 13, 20, we see another word with a double mem, has to do with the heart of Tamar. The thing about Tamar. Tamar is the female representative of a relationship that is being explained by the Tanakh, by the Pentateuch, about the divine designer and his relationship and how he manifests that relationship with us. A woman is often the caregiver. The church is often metaphored with a woman, you know, the bride of Christ. The church is not Christ. It's supposed to be the bride of Christ. It's supposed to be this instrument of Christ caring for the people. And the early church did it, rightly divided bread from house to house, took care of all the social welfare of Christians. And if you go to Pliny, Pliny is talking about Christians who would not take from the tables of Caesar the dainties of rulers. Of course, Proverbs told us the same thing. David told us the same thing. Jesus warned us of the same thing, calling those the rewards of unrighteousness that are full of leaven, full of oppression. And this is what Abraham was trying to get out of his life, this leaven, this oppression. This is what Moses was talking about when he was talking about getting the leaven out. But we also have the representation of a false church, which is a harlot. And Tamar played the harlot. Wow. So is there a connection there? She played the harlot. She wasn't really a harlot. She was collecting what was owed her. And she was given a staff and a medallion and the cord that holds the medallion to the holder, to hold until she got her goat. Well, there's no evidence she ever got her goat. So she's still holding those things. And we know that Judas said she's more righteous than me because he didn't honor what he said he was going to honor. He didn't, and he actually stole time from her. He robbed her of time because he promised, if you wait, give up time to be a mother and to have a child and raise it up, that I will give you my other son. But he didn't do it. And he deprived her. So all that time, you know, you get a life. And it's composed of time and sweat and toil. And what you do with that is yours to decide what to do with. You will have the authority to do with what you produce. It will be yours. Otherwise, unless, of course, you go into bondage, you're entangled again in the yoke of bondage, then maybe 20%, like when they go into Egypt, 20% of their labor won't be theirs. And they'll have to suffer the loss of that and the burden of that loss. They'll be given free bread, but they'll still have less labor than God intended originally. But it was because of their own intent that brings them to this point, because God is a God of the universe and a God of cause and effect. It's built in already. So Tamar was not the harlot that rode the beast, but she was deprived, the true bride was deprived of her power and her place, and she got it back because she was more righteous. Today, there are lots of churches out there, but the truth is, we won't explain it right here, a lot of them are riding the beast. They're more like the priestess of Sumer than the church. They're more like the goddesses of Ur, of the gods of Nimrod, because they don't serve the way that Abraham served the people, or the way that Jacob, who became known as Israel, served the people, or the way that Joseph wanted to serve the people but was thrown into slavery by his brothers. And because of that, his brothers would go into slavery. And there are churches who don't do what Christ said to do, commanded to do. And they will be tempted to ride the beast instead. And they will become the harlot. They won't just play the harlot. They'll be the harlot. So anyway, let's get into, there's not a lot of verses in this chapter 39. There's a lot of stuff in it. At first, I didn't write any notes about it because of the fact that it seemed pretty cut, straightforward, and not a complicated deal. But if you don't understand what Joseph was in Egypt as a part of God's divine plan. His brothers meant it unto evil, but God meant it unto good. Why? Because they wouldn't have survived without the grain of Egypt during the plagues? No, that's commonly... I've read a lot of the commentaries on this particular chapter. I've looked at them all that I could find. And they don't really get it. They don't really understand why God allowed Joseph to go into bondage. He did it not to save his brothers from the famine, but from the famine of their hearts. Because they weren't going the way of Israel. They were going out of the way. We see the example of what we see going on with Judah. But the others were also making mistakes. And making Jacob stink. We cover that in the chapter where he talks about that. But the fact that they did that, he got the sons that he got, that did the things that they did, caused Joseph to make another decision, to do away with all these strange gods, which had nothing to do with the fact that they might have been represented by statues, but had to do with the system of social welfare they were dependent upon. And we've already talked about it. You'll have to go back and look at the other articles, but he built Sukkos for his possessions, which were the people that came with him. And although we don't have a lot of names mentioned, and when they go into bondage in Egypt, they give us a number, but it's the family of Jacob that they're giving us the number. But there were a lot of people that went along with them to herd all these flocks, and they came along sort of as the clients or possessions. I use the word clients because he was giving them way more freedom and independence than Laban would have given them, or Bera would have given them. They literally could have been considered his employees, his human resources, and he could have ruled over them like Abimelech, but he was going back to the way of his father and grandfather, and that was a way of free will offerings. In order to have those free will offerings coming from your own home, your own tent, like Moses sets up, you have to have your own tent. And that's what Jacob was doing. So many people miss this. AI misses it because AI is just listening to people. But Joseph understood it. Israel understood it. But the sons didn't. So they were going to need to go into bondage. You know, just like Jacob was in bondage for 20 years, except they were going to have to go into bondage for 400 years. So how long would you have to go into bondage for you to learn the lessons of Abraham and Jacob and Isaac and Jesus Christ? Because that's where we're at. We're still on the planet that God created in the beginning. The same rules still apply. Everything in the Old Testament is done away with. All Jesus did away with all the misinterpretations of the Old Testament. Jeremiah, Isaiah were all trying to do the same thing. But people keep going back to their delusions. And I see amongst religions today that same spirit of clinging to the metaphor rather than the meaning. I see it amongst the Muslims. I've been doing a study on Sharia law. You know thy enemy. Not that Muslims are my enemy. But Sharia law is the enemy of freedom. It's the enemy of enlightenment. It's the enemy of wisdom. You can study it and study it and study it, and all you'll have is what the Greeks call this amatheia. You'll know a lot about foolishness. But, and the reality is we can pinpoint in time where certain people who are called prophets by some went off track. And we see in the previous chapter where Judah went off track. He was already going off track, but in that chapter is showing us how he went off track and ended up shearing his sheep, shearing his livestock, instead of setting them free. And once you understand the metaphors, it becomes clearer and clearer. And hopefully we'll get to some of that, because we're going to introduce a new environment, a new condition. Joseph in Egypt. Verse 1, chapter 39. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt. And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down thither. And the Lord, Yahweh, L-O, capital, all caps, was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. So Potiphar is an Egyptian. They're telling us this. Most of the commentaries tell us, or many of the commentaries make mention of the fact that the fact that they say that Potiphar is an Egyptian tells us that there were other people that might be holding offices in Pharaoh's kingdom who were not Egyptians. But he was an Egyptian. And it's very important to understand some of the other people. And we mentioned, because we've already done some of the following chapters, and we made reference to the fact that, you know, there was a priest and he had a daughter, and then that becomes somebody's wife, and then the offspring. She's an Egyptian, but her children are part of Israel. And so it's not about bloodline. It's about your walk of faith, because God is the God of all DNA. He can fix your DNA. Now, God does use bloodline at times. Why else do we see Tamara going to be, you know, and, you know, like I said, she's mentioned in Ruth. Why? Because Ruth and Boaz. Ruth is from somewhere else, and Boaz get married, and their offspring are the earlier generations before Jesus Christ. So those things do play in, but if you want to figure out what's going to happen based on bloodlines, you're eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If you just eat of the tree of the spirit, you'll be way better off. And whoever God wants you to marry, you will marry. And you will turn left when you should turn left, and turn right when you should turn right, and you're less likely to have problem with traffic. So anyway, Joseph is there. Now all of a sudden somebody buys him. Why did he buy him? What did he see something when he was at the slave auction? Is the spirit moving somewhere in Potiphar's life? I mean, it was moving in Abimelech's life, and he ended up blessing Abraham. Yet he was a father king, and Jesus says, call no man on earth father in relationship to who's going to rule over you. I mean, your natural father, he has a right to rule over you to a point. And then you have a responsibility to honor him, which has to do with taking care of him. But other than that, you shouldn't make anybody else your father. And of course, that's why we've studied the government. We've mentioned governments are based on the law of the family, the Anaitsus of ancient times, which is the law of the family, where the state becomes your father and the state also becomes your mother, because the state is going to be your protector and it will also be your caregiver. When you have that situation, I can guarantee that the rights of the father and the mother and the family are now diluted or diminished or reduced. This is why great philosophers, including Proverbs, tells us this. Paul tells us this, that if you're desirous of their dainties, the from their table that should be for your welfare, it becomes a snare and a trap. And Peter says you'll become merchandise, human resources in the city of Sodom, like bearers, citizens. You will go back into the bondage of Egypt, because Egypt had that system. Abimelech had been there. He already had that system. And so now this Potiphar owns Joseph. In verse 3, and his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. He's saying here in the text, we don't know that what word he's using, but we know in the text it's using this capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D in the translation, and we know what that word means in the Hebrew, or at least we know what letters they're in that word in the Hebrew, which is the Yad Vayeh, the Yahweh word, the Jehovah word that we see, that you're, this is supposed to be the God of your life, this existing one, this unmoved mover that is appearing in Joseph, because he's with Joseph. And even Potiphar can see it in Joseph. But the brothers couldn't see it in Joseph. When they heard the dream, they saw red. They wanted to get even with their brother. They wanted to remove their brother. Like I said, they wanted to cancel him. But in this verse 3, Potiphar is seeing the Spirit of God in this guy and seeing that everything he puts his hand to is prospering. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, served Potiphar, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hands. So that's how Joseph is coming to power, but he's not in the power in Egypt just for this kind of captain of the guard, who actually is a prince of Egypt based on what we, if you look at the Hebrew in the earlier, you know, he's a captain of the guard, but he's also an officer of Pharaoh. And you can look at that word officer in the Hebrew, and it definitely suggests that he's of the household of Pharaoh. So he's high up, and he trusts Joseph. But in verse 5, and it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, and the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the fields. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hands. He said, this guy's, he's doing it better than I could do it, and this allows me to go do my job as captain of the guard better. So he had complete trust in Joseph. So he's given Joseph all his power. And he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. Now, that kind of power would corrupt most people. But Joseph was listening to the spirit that was walking with him, the Yahweh spirit, the Yad Vayeh, the existing one spirit. And so he wasn't corrupted by it. Not to say that things didn't come along to try to corrupt him. He had all this power, all this control. And Moses was even tempted by it. But Joseph stood his ground. And in verse 7, we see, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said unto his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in this house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. And so he wasn't going to do it. He wasn't going to betray his master. This idea of the sanctity of the family was well established all over the world. Abimelech knew it. That, you know, an unmarried woman in his jurisdiction, he could take her as wife. He would take care of her, and her children would prosper. Her children would. He was able to father many children by her. He was rich, and so he was able to do that. I don't recommend it, but he was able to do that. Was trying to be honorable. He didn't know he took another man's wife. When he found out, he scolded Abraham. You didn't even tell me. You deceived me. You fooled me. You could have got my whole family destroyed. They knew that that was a bad thing. I just heard a CEO of a company found out that two of her employees were cheating on their significant other, husband or wife, whatever. And they were cheating on them with each other. So I guess we're talking about opposites there. And as soon as she, and doing so at work. But she immediately fired them when she found out. And she said she would have fired them even if it wasn't at work. Because if they will betray the trust of the person they say they love, they'll certainly betray me. And you know, I'm not saying that you should fire such a person, but she has a case. A lot of times people make choices and they think it's based on the facts, but it's actually based on the Spirit. And I believe that Joseph was making choices based upon the leading of the Spirit. And this is why everything was prospering. He knew when to plant. He knew who to put in charge of what, because he was following the Holy Spirit that walked with him. And that's what they're saying, is that the Lord was with him and guiding him along the way, and he was prospering. And so we need to understand that that's what he was dealing with. But now he wouldn't touch this woman. But we'll talk more when we come back to Keys of the Kingdom after another brief break. Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So we're in Genesis. We're in chapter 39. And we're down at, verse 9. He's being tempted by this woman. And she wants him to lay with her. And he says, there is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he kept back anything, referring to Potiphar, from me, but thee. Because thou art his wife, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Not just sin against Potiphar, but sin actually against God. How could I do this? This great wickedness. And the Hebrew word there for wickedness is, you know, the root word is resh ayin, which is to actually, you know, ayin has to do with divine providence. And resh ayin is ruling over divine providence, going against the nature of the way in which God established the design. And Jesus talks about this design. No more twain, but one flesh. How can I abuse my master by abusing his wife? Because he would consider that abuse, to rule over his wife, to dominate his wife, to have intercourse with this other man's wife. Even Abimelech, this is a common theme. They're telling you the sacredness of this family unit is so important. But today, that unit is broken down in the media. And, there was a movie where somebody mentions the fact that they're not having sex with their boyfriend, which isn't really their boyfriend, different movie. I won't go into all the details. But somebody says she's not having sex with her boyfriend because she's waiting. And the other person responds, waiting? Like, why would you wait? Because, out of respect. Respect for each other, the respect for the union of your future marriage. You see, this is one of the things, the way Hebrew is written, again, is they're often telling you what's coming and then elaborating upon it. When you get engaged, you're not in marriage yet. You will elaborate on that engagement once you are married. And that's where you come together, but you don't do it beforehand. You could. I mean, you're probably not going to get hit by a lightning bolt. But there will be a cost because we live in a cause and effect universe. And you will have to pay the price of that in some form or another, in some way or another. And you will also pay a price or receive a reward if you wait. And this is it's built into nature that if you go down less than the righteous way, you're pretty righteous still, but you're going to do a little bit less than righteous. You're going to break some of the fundamental realities of nature. It's going to come back to haunt you. You can do this with your diet. You can do this with your relationships with other people. You can do this relationship with your work. You can do this with your relationships with the government that you live in. And of course, today we see it's rampant that people violate their oath of office. I mean, the whole thing with immigration. You know, the way you came into America before, I mean, anybody could just come into America because there was nobody guarding the borders. But if you came into an Indian territory, you could get yourself killed because they may consider you an interloper, but they might like you and befriend you. You didn't know, but you also didn't know necessarily where their boundaries were. But they had boundaries. But once the country was becoming more inhabited and you wanted to, they created a constitution. The constitution gave power, some power to men in government to protect the borders from foreign invasion. And so you came in and you're getting off the boat. How'd you get through? Had you applied to immigration office before? Hadn't been created. The way you got free passage is you held up a contract between you and somebody else who already lived in America. And you say, I'm here to work for so-and-so for 7 years. Or I have a contract to work for 3 years. But usually it was more than seven. And you show that contract and they had to let you pass. Because they couldn't impair the obligation of contract. They couldn't interfere with a contract. This is sacred from way back. This is why Abimelech made agreements with Abraham. Most people miss all this because they don't understand law. They don't understand human nature. They don't understand nature itself. And we can go into that in detail, but we'll never get to the end of this chapter, even though it is short, is that he knew he could not lay with this woman. It would be a great wickedness. He would be not just violating Potiphar, but violating his commitment to God because he would be ruling over something that is divinely initiated, which was the creation of husband and wife. It was a sacred, when I say sacred, it's a separate agreement. Like you could hire somebody and he's working for you, and you pay him for today's labor, and on the way home, he chops somebody else's firewood. Wait a minute. I pay you to work for me. I don't pay you to work for him, but no, he asked me to do it. It's an extra job. I fulfill my obligation to you, but now I'm over here working for this. You can do that with an employee. You can't do that with your wife because it's sacred. It's separate. It's in a different realm, and to violate that realm creates a problem that is now in the spiritual world, but will be manifested in the physical world. Joseph understood that. Joseph would not go along with that wickedness. He would not do that wickedness because he knew, he understood how things worked. So in verse 10, and it came to pass as he spake to, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his business. And there was none of the men of the house there within. There's lots of servants. And she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. And he left his garment in her hand and fled the house. He just ran out because she kind of ambushed him. We don't know the details or anything, but he knew that I'm getting out of here. And he got himself out. And it came to pass that when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto men of her house and spake unto them, saying, see, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass that when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her until his Lord came home. And of course, these are small L-O-R-D. That's the Lord of the house, the Potiphar. And she spake unto him according to these words, saying, the Hebrew servant, now he's making this reference, that this Hebrew servant, which thou hast brought unto us, came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, as I lifted up my voice and cried, and he left his garment with me and fled out. And it came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, after this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. Was his wrath with Joseph, or was his wrath with his wife? Did she know? Did he know she was lying? Did he know what kind of a woman she was? I mean, he knew Joseph was a special kind of guy. I don't know. It's very difficult to tell, but it says that it was when she said these things. You know, because it's kind of repetitious here. He already knows a little bit about what happened. He probably already heard about it from the servants when he was coming home. But now she told him this. After this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. And it says, and Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound. And he was there in the prison. And the Lord was with Joseph, even in the prison, and showed him mercy and gave him favor. So he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. So he knows the keeper of the guard and had trusted him immensely. Now he may have... I believe that he could have been angry with Joseph and thinking Joseph actually did these things and wanted to trust his wife. But this was his wife, and he didn't, even if he thought maybe Joseph didn't do this, he didn't put him to death. He didn't sell him off in a slave market where he would have made money on the deal. He could have sold him to somebody else and said, take this man out of my sight, and I never want to see him again. You know, he could have put him on a ship that was hauling grain out and sold him to somebody. But he didn't do that. He put him in the king's prison, where the king had his own personal prison that he could put people into. And of course, that's where he comes across the cook and the butler, because they were the king had sent him to the king's prison, you know, for time out or whatever. He hadn't completely decided what he was going to do with them, but they were going there, and so they didn't have free. They were kind of in like a house arrest, but they were in a particular place that was called the king's prison. And so the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hands all the prisoners that were in the prison. And whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. So in this prison, these guys are probably not, you know, sitting around looking at, TVs. You know, we have a local prison down here in Lake County. And you can actually have a TV screen at the foot of your bed. You know, one of these flat screen little TV screens. And it keeps the prisoners occupied, you know. And you can lose, you know, they can turn it off and lose privileges and all this stuff. It's kind of a low security prison, but has a lot of sex offenders in there. But I've known some of the prison guards. And the reality is that that's not the kind of prison this was. For many years, people did stuff in prisons. Occasionally, if you were put in a dungeon by the king or something, you might be locked up in there. But generally speaking, you know, they would ship you off to the mines where you'd be, you know, forced labor. They didn't have these big prisons like we have. The fact that he was sent to the king's prison at all showed to me some kind of favoritism. See, you don't just read the Bible. You have to read a lot of history. And reading history is not just reading the opinions of historians. It's actually going back and looking at what's written down. And you can do that a lot of times now because, I mean, you can go right online and actually see some of the early scripts of the Bible, the earliest copies that we have. There are even some places where they have photographs of what would be virtually just called, you know, fragments of what is evidently the Bible, you know, like the Q Gospels. We don't have any copy of the Q Gospels, but it's believed that that's where Mark got a lot of his information because he read other sources, other Gospels, and he put together the Gospel of Mark. And it survived, but the Q Gospels didn't really survive, but fragments of them. And there's the Q Gospels and the M Gospels and the L Gospels. And these are fragments of things written back then that were probably intact at the time that the Gospels were written. And these guys, because some of them never saw Jesus, were writing about the story of Jesus and the message of Jesus. This is what's so important, is that you want to understand the message of Jesus. And there was a message that Jacob brought to his sons, but they couldn't understand it by sitting down in a classroom and being taught it, or even being in the household of Jacob and being taught it. They couldn't understand what it really meant to be Israel. And some of them went completely away from their father's house, like we saw with Judah. Others remained in their father's house, but just couldn't see it. They need to change their condition. That will come up probably on the X call. I've been putting together some quotes. We have the X call on Sunday night. Get a hold of us at Preparing You and find out about it. You can actually look up X space at Preparing You and it will tell you. And then, but join the network and we will actually send you, because you have to have a link to get onto X, and listen to the call. And you can ask questions. So that's available. That's a service that we're providing where you can ask questions about some of these topics. You can contact us other ways, but if you get into the network, you'll have a better access, because I can't talk to everybody all the time. But we're seeing that the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph the hands of the prison. There's not bars slamming shut, but all the things that they were doing, they were probably doing work, they were... You know, I've seen movies about it. I've read what they did in those prisons and everything like that. They might be grinding grain. They might be doing all kinds. But they will be usually put to menial tasks, and they'll have to get those tasks done. But he was actually put into the king's prison, so he's going to meet anybody else that was put into the king's prison. And that's going to be important, because it's going to give him a doorway to the king. Because I am suspecting that Potiphar, I actually know somebody who was named Potiphar. That's actually their name today, although they passed recently. But so the keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, meaning Joseph, and that which he did, and the Lord made it to prosper. So he's just being put, this guy can get it done, and they're trusting him. Like, again, I'm saying the guys who, they're confined to an area, there may be bars, there may not be bars, and they're giving tasks, and they have to fulfill those tasks, and those tasks are going to be related to what is going on in the king's household. They're not able just to go around. And this kind of thing was going on even at the time of Rome, where people would be given like almost housing, but they had to stay in that area. They couldn't go out of that area. And they were protected in that area, but they were restricted in that area. And they were under somebody's resh, under somebody's authority. So when we say he was thrown into prison, we shouldn't be thinking that he was thrown into a prison, you know, like bars, and he's, you know, that, you know, like a prisoner come out and stand there and then go back in and all that kind of stuff. That it was something attached to the household, but you didn't get free rein of going around in the palace. You were stuck in this area, and there were tasks that were put to you, and he was in charge of everything that was going on in the prison. And the head of the prison didn't even have to show up. Joseph was in charge of everything. It's not like Shawshank Redemption, you know. I mean, to some degree, you know, he gets into the warden's office and everything, but he wasn't given the keys by the warden. And then the warden just leaves. But when we say things like prison and guards and princes and stuff like that, all princes aren't the same, all prisons aren't the same, all guards aren't the same, but human nature is the same. And Yahweh is the same. God is the same today as he was yesterday. And he can work in your life, and he can make you prosper. But if you want to serve God because he's going to make you prosper, you're coming at it the wrong way. You're not coming at whatever God is with the Spirit of Christ, because Christ didn't come to prosper. He came to sacrifice. And so if you're going to come in the name of Christ, you have to come to sacrifice. And Joseph was a good servant. And as a good servant, he would make, and he was, I'm sure he was learning lessons all the time that he was doing, and when he was a servant in the house of Potiphar and a servant in the house of the, you know, in the prison. He was learning things about how to do things. And of course, he was doing that back with his brothers when they were going out to check on all the people tending sheep. They weren't just going, oh, let's go out and check the sheep. They're miles away, and we're going to go out and look at the sheep. I put the sheep away yesterday. I'd go out in the desert and watch them, and I'd go out there and worked on the swather, worked on the case tractor, worked on the burn pit, worked on the ditch, and checked the fields, and because I could see the sheep all the time while I was doing that. You know, look over your shoulder and see if any coyotes or bobcats or mountain lions are coming in. You can't just let the sheep go and then say, we're going to go, we'll go back to the town. We'll come back in a couple of days. There won't be any sheep left. No, you have to stay with them. And somebody did. they were going out and checking on the people that were tending to the flocks. You know, if for the cattle, it would be the cowboys, and for the sheep, it would be the shepherds. And for the donkey wranglers, it'd be the donkey wranglers. And they had wives, and they had children, and they had families, and we're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of people. When they made reference to Edom, you know, Esau coming in with 400 men, those men probably had families following them. Even at the time of Alexander the Great, they said that Alexander the Great, when he marched with his army, it was the largest moving population in the history of the world because everybody came along with him. Not only their families, but they had to have shoemakers and saddle makers and armor makers and cookers and bakers and doctors and probably lawyers even to settle disputes. When they took a city-state, they had to take over the government, and they had to put their people, they had to have linguists, of course they had to have historians, people, you know, news people who are keeping the records. Lots of people traveling with his army. They can't just, you know, fly to the front lines for a little bit. They all went, a huge moving population. This is the way Jacob was moving. This is the way Abraham was moving. He could pull up 900 armed men at one time. Well, there had to have been thousands of other people to support 900 armed men. Even when they went out to march, people are going to have to bring supplies and carry a little bit with them. People are going to have to bring, so there's supply lines. They're going to be moving stuff with donkeys. I mean, like when the Romans attacked Masada, there were thousands of donkeys hauling in water every day, food every day for the soldiers, and supply lines and stuff going back and coming back again. So the idea that there was just 70 people that were going to go into this bondage of Egypt, no, it was a lot more in depth than that. And so we should take all that into consideration when we're looking at this idea of Joseph in Egypt. He already knows the language. He's picked that up pretty quick, probably. He already knows not just Potiphar and the prison head, but everybody. He's getting to know the people that are in prison. He's getting to know if there were other guards, other people, if they're bringing in stuff that they have to prosper, you know, whatever. He's learning all this. He's talking to these guys who used to be the butler for Pharaoh and the cook for Pharaoh. He's going to know about people that work in the kitchen and how everything works. He's constantly absorbing all this information. He already knew the captain of the guard. He knew his whole household. He probably knew a lot of the guards because there would be guards, you know, other officers that come to talk to Potiphar. He's learning all these things about Egypt. He's going to be absolutely ready for the next job he gets when he gets it. And it's all part of his preparation. So is God working in your life that way? Well, we'll have to talk about that when we come back to Keys to the Kingdom after another brief break. Welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. So we got through that chapter. We can go on to, we only have, like, I think, one more chapter before we're caught up to where the sections that we've already done in Genesis. But again, I want people to understand that, you know, the Bible's mostly about, I've said this so many times, and people kind of, this is one of those moments where you get the deer in the headlight look. Bible's mostly about government. The word religion shows up five times. It is about faith, and it is also about allegiance. Because, you know, if we take those words, faith and allegiance, faith is belief that compels action. It's not just belief. It's a belief that compels action. It causes you to act and react in a certain way under certain conditions. Allegiance also compels actions, but in order to compel those actions, they will use force to make you do what you swore to do. You know, you took an oath. I mean, recently in the news, just this week, you know, there was a bunch of, I guess, Democrats who came out and was telling all servicemen and servicewomen that if you're told to do something that is unlawful, you don't have to do it. But what they don't tell them is that you'd better consult an attorney before you don't do it, because you're under oath to do what you're told. Now, obviously, you know, like, give you an example from my own history, back when, you know, the incident at My Lai, the massacre at My Lai, there was a helicopter pilot and a gunner flying over a village in Vietnam, and he saw people being shot by American troops and hiding in ditches and fleeing American troops who were just, like, shooting people. Unarmed civilians. And he took down, he landed that helicopter. Callie, I think is his name. I may have that wrong, but, you know, don't quote me on it. But it's been a long time since Vietnam. But anyway, he tells the pilot, you know, land. And, or he was the pilot, and he lands. And he tells the gunner, and when he gets out of the helicopter, he says, if they shoot me, kill them. It's kind of a Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, but not a movie, real life. And he goes out there, I think he had a sidearm on, and he tells them, what the heck are you guys doing? And he put an end to it. There was a massacre. People were killing civilians. The blood was up, and they were killing civilians. It was a terrible atrocity. It's probably not the only one, but it got news coverage. But these were American soldiers, and they were doing bad things. But this is why you want to avoid war, is that when you have war, you know, you can sit back in your ivory towers and think, oh, well, you know, they shouldn't do those. That's naughty of them. But you're not getting shot at every day. You're not missing sleep every night. You're not got foot rot. You're not seeing your buddies blown apart. You're not getting ambushed in the jungle. They are. It takes a toll on men. Side effect of war is atrocities. It's going to happen. Don't excuse it. You want to stop it? Well, he did. And fortunately, the gunner, you know, agreed that he was going to shoot him. He was going, and he had a bigger gun than them. On that helicopter, he could do that. But I don't know if he could fly the helicopter out of there, because the pilot just got out, went up and confronted these people. Took tremendous courage to do that. Or stupidity. Maybe some of that amathia. You know, I don't know how old he was at the time. Maybe his frontal lobe hadn't kicked in. But he went out and did what needed to be done and faced danger and took it. And to go out and tell servicemen now, you know, and no explanation of what a lawful order looks like. You know, I mean, the same people that were ordering, or, you know, telling soldiers that they didn't have to obey orders from Donald Trump, the commander-in-chief, if they thought they were unlawful. No, they have to know they're unlawful. And there should be plenty of evidence to prove that they're unlawful. Otherwise, you could get shot. You could be put up against a wall and shot. So, yeah, that was not only bad advice. It was just, they were trying to get clicks. And of course, the citizens listening to this should know better. But they don't. For the same thing we talked about, they don't know anything about jury nullification, deciding fact and law in a jury. They don't understand the laws of their own country. They never read the Judiciary Act of 1789. But then a lot of these preachers out there telling you, you know, about Christ and everything, they never read Pliny either. Pliny the Younger. What was the dispute? Pliny the Younger was a judge. So he was looking at Christians and prosecuting them. You know, he was also hiring engineers to cover a river that was flowing through a town. And he was writing Trajan, like, could you come up with, you know, it's going to take 40,000 Xerxes to do this. Do you think we ought to do it? Trajan said, yeah, we probably ought to do that. It's worth it. Because they were using a creek, a river, literally, that flowed through their town as a sewer dump. And it was stinking. And he And Pliny even writes that this is a health hazard. That if you live in filth, people get sick. They already knew that. They weren't dummies. They didn't have germ theory yet, but they know you don't live in your waste without consequences. He also had somebody who had lived in Parthia and had been seized by two cooks. And I won't go into all the details of that, but basically he had a ring that had the image of the king of Parthia on the ring. Well, Trajan was the emperor, and he was going to be battling with the Parthians to take their land and their gold and take power over them. And so to have a ring with the likeness of the king of Parthia on it might be handy. And so he wrote him that, I'm going to send it to you as soon as I get it. And he sent along some ore samples from a mine in Parthia, thought that Trajan would like to see that. And he was doing all kinds of things, building buildings, finances, all this stuff. There's only, what was it, letter 96 and 97 that mentions Christians. But people still to this day think, oh, well, Christians, Jesus never existed. There's so much evidence that he existed. And going back to what I mentioned before, the Q Gospels. And I'm bringing up these things. We've kind of gone through this chapter. But I'm also trying to awaken you to the events in which history takes place. Why is that important? Why God thinks it's important that you're free. Somebody named Theodore Herzl, sounds like he's Jewish, once said, whoever would change men must change the condition of their lives. Now, that quote's been heard a lot to promote social welfare. But the reality is that I'm not sure what Herzl meant by it, but if you want to destroy a society, David talks about this, you know, years before Polybius talked about it, and the Proverbs talks about it, if you sit and eat with rulers, you be a man of appetite, put a knife to your throat, because he serves you deceitful meats, because sitting and eat with rulers is changing your condition. When Joseph lived in the house of Potiphar, that changed his condition. But it didn't make him an immoral man. He had opportunity, but it didn't make him an immoral man because he walked with the Lord. And what he chose to do while he was in that position of power was to serve. And we see that when he's found grace in the sight of Potiphar. Or maybe, I was going to bring this up, is that in that verse, I think it's verse 4, Joseph found grace in his sight. Does that mean that he found that Potiphar was going to give grace to Joseph, or Joseph was going to give grace to Potiphar because he saw grace in Potiphar? Because it's not really clear if you look at the word order, and I find out more and more how word order is very important, and they don't always give it to us. That's why you have to go back to the original text. But the point is, it says that he served. That when he served him. That's Joseph serving, you know, Potiphar. And to some degrees, it might be served, you know, where Potiphar is now going to serve Joseph too because he's given him power. The word serve there is very commonly translated minister. That's Sharath is the word that we see there, which is Shin Resh Tov. And there's other words for serve, but this word, you know, I think it's translated minister like 60 times. But it's translated serve 17 times. It's one of those times. It's also translated servant. And of course, when you start seeing that, they're adding extra letters. But it means to serve or to minister to. So he's ministering. He is a minister of the captain of the guards now. But he's serving Potiphar. And this, whatever job you do, if you're an employee, or you're working for yourself, and even when you're working for yourself, you're usually making something for somebody else or fixing something for somebody else. You have to do it like you genuinely want to serve that person, and you will prosper. And, you know, when Callie stepped out of that helicopter and went up there and stopped that genocide of that village, he was serving those people. But he was also serving the soldiers that had gotten out of control and were becoming murderers and killers. I mean, like, what do you do? Everybody wasn't necessarily shooting people, but there was enough people shooting people that people were dying. I don't remember the death toll, but it was terrible. But again, Joseph is being put in this place in order to serve his brothers by bringing them into bondage. He's also serving his father because his father could not get the brothers to not be tempted by the power of their office over the possessions of Jacob. They could not become ministers of Israel with their existing attitude because they would bring in the leaven that Jesus warns us. You know, beware of the leaven of Herod and the Pharisees. And, of course, we've already explained time and time again. I have an article up on it. Leaven has to do with oppression. If you get all the yeast out of your house, but there's still oppression in your house, you're still in trouble. Because you haven't got all the leaven out, because you haven't got all the oppression out. If you get no yeast out of your house, you have yeast in your house all over the place, you're fine. If you have no oppression in your house or in your spirit. What God is going to do is change the condition of the sons of Joseph. That condition is going to go to being free souls in the household of Jacob to being in the bondage of Egypt. And by changing their condition, they will be changed ultimately or die. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And so, but that God wants you to be stronger in the ways of righteousness. So people begging for socialism. Socialism is that one purse that Proverbs tells you not to have. It will turn into the cities of blood, the cauldron of flesh that it talks about in the Bible. You can look up those words at Preparing You, and we have whole articles. The cauldrons of flesh mentioned numerous times in the Testaments. What are they talking about? What are the dainties of rulers? And like, I can quote Plutarch, I can quote Polybius, I can Socrates, Plato. Although, you know, like Plato's Republic was the reverse of what a republic was supposed to be. It's kind of an oxymoron, but that's another topic. But, you know, when the masses develop an appetite for benefits from rulers, from men who exercise authority, you're changing the condition of the people. And the people will be changed by that. Joseph was not changed when he was put in positions of power. He was not changed when he was put into a prison. Because he walked with the Lord. But today in America, today in the world, in general, I see people being changed. That's why we have gender confusion. That's why we have corruption. That's why we have the breakdown of the family. Because with the breakdown of the family, the fathers of the earth will rise up and become tyrants. Because when you know, this is why they tell you that power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Because when you give power to other men to rule over you and over your thinking, you change your condition. And you are changed by it. Because you're living by the world, the flesh, and the devil. The evil spirits. And if you deny your error, you'll live more and more in darkness. And you will do wicked things. You will violate. You know, when people have premarital relationships, they're already cheating on their spouse-to-be. They're in an earlier time. Well, I don't have a wife, so it doesn't count. But no, you're already cheating on your wife-to-be. And there's a consequence. You think you'll get away with it. Nobody caught you. Nobody saw you. But you didn't get away with it. I always wonder, whatever happened to Potiphar's wife? we saw earlier in the previous chapter where the sons of Judah just died one after another because they were straying from the formula. They were losing the blessings of that previous generation. They were given life by Joseph, but they cut themselves off from the life that Abraham was finding for his sons and Jacob, Isaac and then Jacob were finding also. So the reality is we don't want to lose track of this idea of the condition of our life. Socialism will, this is what they tell you in Proverbs, you know, having the one purse, it runs towards death. This is what Polybius tells you, that the people will be degenerated if you have a habit of receiving benefits by the rule of force. Mondami didn't learn that in school. And the Muslim religion almost never teaches it. And, you know, I want to be careful not to put all Muslims in some sort of Muslim basket. But the same as I wouldn't put all Christians in the same. I think many, many Christians, according to Christ, are not following Christ, but they think they are. Because he said many would be deceived. They'll be workers of iniquity. They will be doers of idolatry. And we talked about that at the beginning. We were going full circle, like all of our rabbit trails, always run in circles and come back to where we were. So what's the deal? Is that you're going in this whole circle where you're coming back in your doings, and what you thought you were going to get away with ends up being a curse. That you're not getting away with anything. That you're being lost in this process of the world, because you didn't accept an important idea, that you were to live by faith, hope, and charity. You wanted to live by the benefits of men who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority, which is the wages of unrighteousness and is a covetous practice. You desire benefits at the expense of your neighbor. That's not loving your neighbor. If love is the same word for charity, you're not loving your neighbor if you're desiring benefits at the expense of your neighbor. And that's the essence of socialism. Those that produce more, they're going to share with those who don't produce enough. But it's a political system where somebody tells you you have to share. Christ is creating an environment, a condition where you have to choose to share. And there's no penalty if you don't. If you don't share, you say, okay, I made a lot of money, but I'm not sharing this month because I'm going to need that next month because the Holy Spirit tells me I'm going to need that. But I'll make more, and then sometime down in the future, I will share what I produce. You know, everybody wants to take Elon Musk, take all his wealth and give it away. He does give it away, but he gives it away to men that are working. He employs like 100,000 people. I think that's the figure. I mean, that's almost hard to even imagine, you know, with all of his companies. But all those men working, they're going to go to the restaurant. They're going to buy a house. They're going to employ another 500,000. Elon Musk is providing daily bread for probably 1 million people because he's very good at organizing a business. And people say, well, he's SpaceX is getting government contracts. Well, yeah, but he's putting up private satellites. He's building the satellites even sometimes. And he's doing it way cheaper than almost anybody else in the world. And he's saving all kinds. I'm not advocating, because I really think the absolutely important thing is you find out what Christ was really doing, what Abraham was really doing, what Jacob was really trying to do, and try that. Let's try to do that. It's not socialism. It is sharing. But if you're going to be king in your own family, king in your own castle, if we're going to set the captive free and return every man to his family and every man to his possession, we're going to have to allow him to decide how his possessions are redistributed. He is the means of production. It isn't the iron, it isn't the aluminum, it isn't the gold. Those aren't the means of production. He is the means of production. Those are dirt in the ground we walk on until a man comes along and sweats and toils to produce. He is the means of production. And the means and method of your society is going to determine the outcome of your society. And they're either going to be the means and method of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jesus, and all the prophets, or they're going to be the means and methods of Nimrod, and Bera, and Caesar, and Pharaoh, and FDR. They're going to be the means of force, to force your neighbor to contribute to your welfare in these flesh pots of socialism. You don't want that. You want to do what Christ actually did. And unfortunately, the priests of your society, the ministers of your society, Joseph was a minister. That's the word. It says that he served. It says he ministered. It's the word most commonly translated minister. But your ministers are tickling your ears in churches, while the real ministers to your family are men who exercise authority one over the other, but call themselves benefactors and don't give you anything except what they take away from your neighbor. Because the United States and Australia and England and Canada are all socialist filled, let's put it this way, they're filled with the system and spirit of socialism, where they think it's okay to take away the life of their neighbor to benefit their household. And of course, they destroy their own family when they do so. So much so, I mentioned Canada. Read about MAID in Canada. M-A-I-D, MAID in Canada. It's assisted suicide. You're not useful, we're going to kill you. And they're selling that. In America, we don't necessarily do that, but do we? I know a number of people on hospice right now. What are they, got them on morphine and sedatives? Well, we'll have to talk about that another time. Join us on X. See you next week. Join the network at preparingyou.com. Find out what the kingdom is all about. Until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.